Merry Christmas, everybody.
A 26-year-old man has been charged with the murder of a healthcare boss in New York. Luigi Mangione was found in a McDonald's in Pennsylvania yesterday. He's been arrested on suspicion of shooting United Healthcare chief exec Brian Thompson in Manhattan last Wednesday. New York City Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch said it was a collaborative effort to find him.
We all serve the same public safety mission. And this case, which captured the attention of an entire nation, is another example of how connected we are and how important it is to work together, share information, and pursue every lead.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is taking the stand today in his long-running trial for alleged corruption. It's the first time an Israeli Prime Minister will take the stand as a criminal defendant. And the annual rent for a student room in London has risen by nearly a fifth in 2 years. A report found the average annual rent for a room is now over £13,500. Meanwhile, the maximum student loan is just under that. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Liv Thompson.
He weren't supposed to burn the potatoes. Or invite everyone round at 2. We said 3. You weren't supposed to fall asleep on the sofa. Or ask me to marry you. And you weren't supposed to be here. But you are, thanks to the best gift you ever got. And mine is still having you.
When you donate to the British Heart Foundation, you give a gift that keeps on living. Search BHF today and help us fund life-saving research.
Coming up, Africa in Focus.
NHS England is launching the next phase of their Pharmacy First advertising campaign that raises awareness of the expanded services available at your community pharmacy. Those services mean that pharmacists can now provide some prescription medicine, if needed, for 7 common conditions without the need to see a GP first. Going to your local pharmacy offers an easy and convenient way to get clinical advice on minor health concerns. And now community pharmacies can offer treatment and, when appropriate, some prescription medicine for 7 common conditions without GP appointment. This is part of a major transformation in the way the NHS delivers care. Community pharmacies are staffed by highly skilled and qualified health professionals who are trusted parts of local communities. Pharmacists can train for 5 years in the use of medicines before they qualify and are also trained in clinically assessing and treating minor illnesses and giving health and well-being advice to help people stay well. Pharmacy technicians are part of the pharmacy team and are also registered health professionals.
You might want to step back from your speaker or remove your headphones.
Yes! I just can't believe it.
Mark's found out he's won £11.4 million on Lotto.
This is just... You know what? I've got tears in my eyes.
Yep, that's 11.4 million. Lotto, will you be the next millionaire? The National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, colorful.com and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Africa in Focus.
Colorful radio.
Good morning, good evening, depending on the time zone you are listening to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus. I'm your host, Julius Baluto. And we're coming to you from the heart of London to wherever you are, all the way on Colorful Radio. Welcome to the show. In our studios today, we are graced by a great man. He's doing great work. He's impacting Africa. And his name is Ben Anim Antwi. And he's from Ghana. Welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah,
God, great. Indeed.
Please introduce yourself because you are here with me. I don't want to talk on your behalf.
So, yes. So, you gave me a powerful introduction. And man, as I said, my name is Ben Anim Antwi. Originally from Ghana. I run a NGO and a youth charity called Future of Ghana, where we create platforms for young Ghanaians to connect and share knowledge, their skills for the development of Ghana. And we've been doing that since 2015. Initially, we started with a publication which showcased the top 30 under 30 Ghanaians globally in various sectors. We also do advocacy work on behalf of the youth to make sure that their voice is heard in government, and we run volunteer programs in Ghana as well.
Wow. How many years have you done that for?
Since 2015. So it's, approaching 9 years.
Wow. How has it been?
It's been good. It's been a journey. It's been really good to connect with Ghanaians globally, to understand and see the talent that we have worldwide. But not just in the diaspora, in Ghana itself, because sometimes often with Africa, we always look into the diaspora because they're outside, they're in the West, they're in other countries. But there's talent within the country, and we've been able to uncover that and connect them with the talent outside. So it's been a very interesting journey so far.
What you're saying is like your platform between the diaspora and those on the ground.
Yes, so we work with young Ghanaians globally, so it doesn't matter. Obviously, there's a strong focus on the diaspora because we're based in the UK, and you'll see from the government as well, a lot of their policies are aimed at that diaspora, because we know that the diaspora has power, not just in their skills, but in remittances, in the money they send back to the country. So it's a key group to engage. But we mustn't forget about, you know, the Ghanaians on the ground, the local Ghanaians, young Ghanaians who are doing amazing things, who also need to be invested into, so...
Yeah, a couple of years back, I saw the government fronting a campaign. They used to call it Coming Back Home.
Yes.
I mean,
beyond the return.
In your case, have you been diaspora going back home, or all this began from Ghana and you carried on?
Yeah, so I've been, my journey is I've been to Ghana regularly since I was a child. So I'd always go back every other year. And obviously the work that I do in Future of Ghana meant that I was returning to Ghana a lot more. But as you said, around about, I would say, 2018, the government really had a push for people to come back to Ghana. They had the Diaspora Homecoming Summit in 2017, and the following year they had the Full Circle Summit, which attracted a lot of Hollywood. And since then, Ghana's become the Florida, the Miami of Africa. Every Christmas, you know, everybody's there, basically. You know, tourism numbers are sky high in Ghana, and there's a lot of investment and a lot of good things happening in Ghana at the moment. But we mustn't forget the challenges that we do have as well, particularly on this Independence Day. It's really good to see, you know, Ghana, you know, being showcased on a global scale. But also we must remember that, you know, there's challenges that the country face that need to be addressed too.
Away from the challenges, Ghana tends to be a very historical country, because when you talk about, maybe you may share a little bit more because you're on the ground there, but people read history, we remember the era of slave trade. Actually, they say everybody from Africa who ended up a slave in the Western Hemisphere somewhere, they exited from Ghana.
Yes, so you have Elmina Castle and you have
Elmina Castle.
Yeah, and Cape Coast Castle. Both of those two castles are based in Cape Coast region of Ghana. And yeah, that's a huge tourist attraction, obviously, because of the reasons that you've mentioned. There is key links to the slave trade in Ghana as well. So yeah, it has a rich history, you know, the Ashanti culture as well. The Gar culture in Accra as well. It has a rich culture, the Iwe. You know, there's so many different cultures in Ghana. So, you know, it's definitely, obviously, being the first sub-Saharan country to gain independence, it's always had standing in that sense as well. So it's a proud time. Obviously, Ghana independence is always a proud time. It's always, you know, we're proud to be Ghanaian 365 days of the year. But when Ghana independence comes around, often that pride is showcased more as well. But what we like to do at Future of Ghana is independence is not only to look at the history, but look at the future. I mean, it's good to look back and say, okay, where have we come from 67 years? But what are the next 67 years going to look like? Who's going to impact that? You know what I mean? And are there the structures in place to make sure Ghana flourishes in the next 67? So that's where we're looking at. And we believe that the youth hold the key to that. You know, all the studies show that, you know, within probably 5 years, Ghana will have, not Ghana, even Africa in general, will have the biggest youth population. So the future really is Africa. And you can see that, you know, people are looking to invest there. But Ghana needs to make sure it's positioned to reap the rewards of this.
When I was a child, I wanted to be, well, I used to tell my grandma, when I grow up, I'll buy for her a plane.
Really?
And by that way of thinking, I used to think, I'll be a pilot.
Okay.
but it never happened.
Oh, no.
So sometimes it's instructive why we do what we do. So in your case, what really motivated you to come up with the future of Ghana?
It was a few of us that started us, four founding members initially started it. And really, it was just, you know, the need to want to give back to Ghana. Like, I've always had a strong connection to my culture. Even though I was born in the UK, my parents kept that culture alive. And as I said, I used to go to Ghana as a child. And, you know, I wanted to do something more, you know, than actually just visiting. I wanted to actually try and build something to give back, but also to connect with Ghanaians as well. Because what we realized is in the UK, there were so much other people like us that had that yearning to want to contribute to Ghana's development. So that's really what it was. It was that passion amongst young people to really, you know, we respected what our parents had done. They laid the foundations by coming here, you know, and seeking a better life and, you know, putting us through education and stuff. And we kind of felt like we owe it back to them and the country to use our skills really to contribute to the Ghana's development. So that's really what it was. That was the drive behind it.
Well, and in terms of the numbers, what are the numbers like? And let's talk about the numbers first and the impact that you're already having.
Mm-hmm. So numbers in the sense of how much people we've impacted and stuff like that?
Through your operations.
Okay, so since 2015, we've showcased 150 Ghanaian pioneers. So we have an alumni of 150 pioneers that we regularly engage and keep up to date and really showcase them and push them through to various opportunities. In fact, today we're launching our alumni accolade series. And basically that is just a series to showcase 10 of the 150 pioneers who since their selection have transcended their achievements. So have gone on to greater things or maybe completely changed sector or career to what they were selected for. That in itself is powerful because we feel like network is extremely powerful. And then over the course of 9 years, we've run workshops and held volunteer programs with an uptake of about 5,000 people across those 9 years, both in the UK and in Ghana as well. It should also be noted as well that in 2016, we founded a chapter of Future of Ghana in Germany. So there's actually a Future of Ghana branch in Germany as well, who operate in Hamburg and Hanover. And they've been running since 2016, and they're doing remarkable stuff as well in Germany as well. So yeah, it's been a great journey, and there's been a lot of impact that's been made. You know, our annual report from 2015 to 2020 is online, and that can be read, and that shows and illustrates the impact we've had since creation, really. So
yeah, and in terms of thinking about it, will it be correct to say that you exist to connect youths to opportunities in Ghana and maybe in diaspora? Is that the case?
Yes, that's so, but also as well, actually connecting themselves to each other as well to share skills and knowledge, you know, for the betterment of Ghana. So yeah, it's twofold. And then there's definitely the advocacy element as well. Because, you know, we feel it's important for the youth to be heard. You know, the statistic I mentioned about Africa being the youngest population, you know, you'd be a fool if you're an African government not to be engaging the youth with that statistic. So we try to make sure that they're on the table. And then also volunteering, we feel, is very, very important as well, because with the influx of migration into Ghana, and just through people who are resettling there, but also through tourism, I think it's important that people understand and have an element of civic responsibility, understand things on the ground. You know, we're not just coming to Ghana to party and go to all the best restaurants, but also what are the structures in Ghana? How do they work and how can you get involved? So we run volunteer programs to balance that element as well. Because as much as, yeah, it's great, you know, for the diaspora to go to Ghana and build businesses as well, you know, it's even better to help try and help them solve challenges there as well.
Yeah, in the early days, of course, it's good you mentioned that Ghana was the first country in Africa to become independent. And of course, we remember Dr. Kwame Nkrumah talking about, in support of Pan-Africanism, saying Ghana is yet not free, if all other countries in Africa are not free.
Yeah.
So if we were to relive that moment of and Dr. Kwame Nkrumah and bring it to speed up to now, right now, what are your thoughts? What comes in your mind in terms of Africa itself vis-a-vis Ghana's experience?
In terms of the progress it's made since then, or yes, it's kind of, I think it's a balance, to be honest, because you know what, you speak to people and some people will say that, you know, amazingly, that they were better off with the British, that there was more structure. And since, you know, we've held, you know, Kwame Nkrumah's famous speech said the African man has to handle his own affairs. But some people would argue that since we've actually handled our own affairs, we haven't done a good job about it. You know, you speak about corruption, and I know corruption's all over the world. It's not just in Africa. So we shouldn't just, but I think Africa being a developing continent, when there is corruption, it stings more, the impact is felt greater. And I think we've struggled with that. Not just Ghana, just, you know, Africa in general. So I think, although we've definitely made strides, obviously, in being independent from, you know, colonial rule, there is still a long way to go. I think with Ghana, you know, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would say Ghana was in a great place. But it seems that the last 5 years, ironically, although tourism has shot up and the profile of Ghana has risen and more people are visiting the country, it seems as though we've gone a little bit backwards in terms of the economy. I mean, you look at the youth unemployment figures are terrible. And even last year, you had mass demonstrations by the youth just because a lot of them are just disillusioned with life in Ghana. And it seems that a picture is being painted of, okay, there's great opportunities. And yes, there's people coming to Ghana to build businesses, but there's also people there that, you know, the cost of living sky high, you know, lack of jobs, lack of employment. And then there's also issues of corruption that, you know, people don't necessarily feel are being dealt with. So it's a real mixed bag, to be honest with you.
This is Colorful Radio.
When you see your position, of course, the people you are dealing with, the youths, and the political structures in Ghana, just like in many countries in the rest of Africa, they tend to have that paternalistic hierarchy, which is also money-oriented, and sometimes it's about how much money one has.
Yes.
And their age, their lack of ideas,
yes,
never matters.
Yeah.
But if you look into the current generation of leaders, especially political leaders, and the youth, kind of a bit of disconnect here and there, because youths are like overwhelmed. If they don't have jobs, they're incarcerated into a country that will get a contract from China and bring everyone from China to execute it.
Yeah.
Or yet in the universities locally, they studied engineering,
but they
bring engineers from China.
Yes.
I mean, situations like these, what, when you interact with youths, what comes on their minds? And, you know,
like I've said, you just mentioned, there's a lot of disillusionment for those very reasons. You know, if people are, you know, studying, doing the right thing, trying to, you know, earn educational qualifications, but they can't get the jobs, there's obviously going to be that bitterness about it. And as I said last year, you know, there was widespread protests to occupy Judah House. You know, those protests weren't primarily about jobs. They were about various things in Ghanaian society, from the economy to corruption. But a large, you know, proportion of the anger was demonstrated at, you know, the unemployment and the lack of opportunities. And this is where you have, for me, a real battle and a challenge between the diaspora and the local community, because although you do need to engage the diaspora, if you look at it, a lot of Ghana's policies are aimed at people that don't actually live in the country. So you would be excused, if you're a young person living there, to think, does my voice matter? Do they really care about, you know, do they really care about me? And I think the government, and there's elections this year, you know, whoever is elected has a real challenge on their hands to really, you know, make sure and ensure that, you know, the young people's lives do matter and their futures do matter. It's hard. It's definitely hard for young people, because there's so much brilliant, bright minds. You know, the work that we've done at Future of Ghana has uncovered so many bright minds in Ghana, so many people. And, you know, often the dream for us is like for people to want to come to Ghana and actually live there and school there and have you know, faith in the health systems, as opposed to actually wanting to leave Ghana and go to Europe or the West to have a better life. We need to reverse that trend. But we can only reverse that trend, you know, if the government really invests in the people. And as you said, you know, with foreign investment comes that balance, you know. Do I need to employ local people, or is it easier to get, you know, Chinese or whoever the foreign people may be in exchange for, you know, building a road or whatever? But we need to be really mindful, especially, you know, if we want to really see real progress. Because like we said, with this youth population in Africa, if with their bright minds, they know their worth. And you know, Generation Z already, they are very, very entrepreneurial. They're very, they say it as it is. They will simply leave. There'll be a max exodus of young people, and they'll go and benefit someone else's economy, whether it be in Europe, China, America. So it's on, you know, the leadership in Ghana and Africa in general to really hold on to the youth.
And when you look into the diaspora experience, of course, I saw the great campaign about come back home.
Yes.
By the government in Ghana. And how appealing was it to the youths? And while you are thinking of that question as well, there's an additional one there.
Yeah.
In many countries in from Africa, they keep yapping, talking about how great diaspora is, because they do a lot of remittances.
Yes.
But when it comes to do things that matter, that makes you feel like you're a citizen again of that country, they are like hesitant to embrace you when you are from the diaspora.
Yes.
So with the diaspora youth, what has been their story? You know, going back, did they find a wonderful time where they celebrated? Are they now excelling and excelling in whatever they are doing? Or?
Yeah, so again, I think it's a mix of things. I think, you know, ironically, I would say like maybe 10 years ago, because I feel like diaspora, that has become a buzzword in the last like 5 years, diaspora, diaspora. But the reality is there has been migration from the diaspora into Ghana for a long time. From early as I can remember, from about 2012, you had a lot of young people going out to set businesses. But again, there wasn't necessarily the structure and that full backing, you know, campaign to say, come home, we're going to support you. So a lot of people I know actually, around about 2012, they'd gone out and they tried to start a business. They ended up coming back. But obviously since then, with, you know, with these campaigns to get people to come back, I think it's been a mixed reception, and I think we need to distinguish between actually going back for a holiday and actually permanently living there. Two completely different things, because the experience you get from a holiday from 2 weeks is going to be amazing. You're going to think Africa's the land of milk and honey, and in some ways it is. But living there, having to deal with, you know, somehow slow things are, the bureaucracy, it's testing. And I feel like, you know, as much as, you know, the campaigns are saying come back home, there has to be improvement in structures as well. Because as Africans, a lot of the time, and it's the same in Ghana, we say, well, that's just the way things are. That's Ghana. But we have to ask ourselves, is it good? Is it effective? We can't just say that's the, because that's the way it is, we have to accept it. You know what I mean? We have to get to a point where we're actually questioning, is this detrimental to our people? And if it is, let's change it. Regardless of that, if that's been the way for 50 years. And I think that's where we need to get around, because often, you know, I get it, you have to acclimatize to the country you're in, I get it, but at the same time, we shouldn't have to accept conditions that are detrimental to us and just, you know, just brush them aside by saying, okay, well, that's the way things are. So, you know, there's been many success stories, and there's people in our network who are success stories. I think about Lorraine Wright, Terry Afram, Lexi Bwahini, Sangu Dele. There's people that have come from the diaspora and you know, been able to embrace Ghana and, you know, make it work. Others have found it quite difficult. But I think, you know, the government has an office, the Office of Diaspora Relations at the President's office. And that's like a one-stop office for the diaspora to get help and assistance. But I think we still need to go a bit further in that regard. And I think also, lastly, we need to also remember, you know, like you just said, the remittances is really powerful in terms of generating, putting money into the economy. But, you know, going there and impacting is two different things. So I think we need to remember that actually not everyone, in the nicest possible way, not everyone should come back. Because if everyone comes back, who's going to send money? I think we need, and that's the honest truth. Like, we need a balance. You know, if everyone goes, where's the remittances coming from? So we need some people to actually stay.
Yeah.
And we need some people, and it needs to be a flow, you know. And that's where we need to get to. But I think that, you know, generally the young people are very, very enthusiastic about Ghana. And because, you know, as a black person in the West, you know, you can have an identity crisis. We ran a research report in 2018 around identity remittances and different things for second generation Ghanaians, you know. And most of our studies showed that the vast percentage of second generation Ghanaians in the UK didn't see themselves as British, even though they were born here and had a UK passport. So that tells you that they have affinity to Ghana and they really want to engage in Ghana. But, you know, the government and those in power need to make things easier as well, you know, because you talk about coming back home, but, you know, it's only till recently you were given a 10-year visa. Before, you only had 5 years. The plane tickets to Ghana are sky high. So how are you making it accessible for people to actually come back? If you've got a family of, like, say, five, you're easily paying close to $7,000 just to fly back. That is a lot of money in the current climate. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done.
Indeed. When we talk about the office of diaspora being in the status of the president's office,
yeah.
When we talk about, like they do it in some other countries, they say, wow, we have a diaspora desk on foreign affairs ministry.
Yes.
And that diaspora desk is on the ground in Africa.
Yes.
Thousands of miles away from diaspora, whichever country
yes.
you're in.
Yes.
And of course, when that is there, you don't even know how useful that desk is. You don't know how useful that office is. Mm. And with youths, right, we are talking about generation of TikTok. They like to see things work.
Yeah.
We call it, you know, over the top. Over the counter meal, ready meal yes, generation, yeah,
yeah. Microwave.
So you are not gonna waste their time thinking, oh, come to this office, go to another. No, they just want to see everything on their phone.
Yes,
ready to use.
Yes.
So, what do you think about these arrangements?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the previous government, before this government were in power, they had a diaspora office in the MFA, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is based in Accra. This government then moved the office to the president's office. And you know, the reasoning behind that is because they wanted it to show the importance that the president places on diaspora affairs. And to be fair to Ghana, it is a very accessible office. It's very well publicized. So you definitely know where it is and you can definitely go there. My question would be, about that office, like you said, is how does it work reciprocally? Because yes, if you're a diaspora and you're coming to Ghana, yes, you can engage the office, which is brilliant. But we need to get in a position for effective diaspora engagement where I can be in the UK and it can be just as effective. Because that's the whole point. Diaspora are people that are outside of the country.
Exactly.
So if I'm coming for a holiday, I might not want to do business. I might have family in the village far, far that I can't. So it's a thing where how are we actually utilizing our foreign ministries here to provide an effective diaspora service? And it shouldn't be that I get a better diaspora service in Ghana than one outside the diaspora. Actually, I should probably get a better one outside because that's what it's there for. So I think we haven't quite worked at that out. And, you know, we have a system of foreign affairs and different embassies across the world where we need to have an effective desk here that can be just as effective as, because it's often, like I said, the Office of Diaspora Affairs, you know, does a great job in its own right, but it's often kind of publicized as actually you need to physically go there to get anything, to make things happen.
Which doesn't help because even when you say it's in the president's office, how accessible is it? Because anything that's presidential, you begin to think of security implications and are you going to be allowed in or not?
This is it. And to be honest, my own personal view is, like, I understand the reasoning for it being there and the prestige it gives to the diaspora. But my personal view is that it should be in the MFA anyway.
It should be in the embassies.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm thinking.
And it should be. And it
because
should
that's be where the immediate point of engagement with the diaspora.
Colorful radio.
there should be a network. We should be using our network of embassies to connect a lot better. Because really, that's what it like. Because often, even amongst like family members and friends, when you know, since young, the term that we've had has always been like, if you want to do business, you have to be there. Which that doesn't make sense, because if I wanted to do business in the US, I wouldn't necessarily have to be in the US. So we need to get to a stage where we can actually trust the systems that we can actually do business and get things done from outside. Exactly. That's why we're diaspora. So we're not there yet. And we do need to get to a place where we're there. And a lot of it is trust issues. And I said, a lot of it is about the right structures being in place in order for that to happen.
Indeed. Kenya, for example, came up with an amazing campaign. I mean, Kenyans in the diaspora say, excuse me, don't talk about our remittances. We want to talk about make us feel like Kenyans. And over the years, they've been campaigning for things that matter to them. And as we speak now, out of all these, you know, pressure, Kenyans diaspora can vote. It's been implemented, but progressively. It's not quite there yet, because when you talk about, yes, as a government or you know, institutions of electoral institutions have given Kenyans in the diaspora the right to vote. You realize when you come to the UK, it's not easy when you say vote in the embassy in London. It's not easy for someone in Scotland, someone in Wales, someone in Northern Ireland to, they may have to fly to come and vote.
Yeah.
Would the government give them a refund for the airfare? Oh, some of them may have to fly, but also spending in an hotel.
Yeah,
because of the queues, thinking about the queue the day after. The same thing when you go to the US. Some states are far from each other, extremely far.
Yeah.
It could be a couple of hours flights, not so near. Yet when you say you've given Kenyans in America the right to vote, what are you talking about? Where will they be voting? Will you take the process closer to them?
Yeah.
There are those thorny issues, but that's where Kenya is right now. But after a lot of political bargaining and pressure. So I don't know about Ghana. Does Ghanaian diaspora vote?
A couple of years ago, there was, I believe, and don't quote me on this, but there was the Roper Law. I know that's correct. And the Roper Law was basically to enable Ghanaians abroad to vote. So I know it can happen because there's legislation that allows for it. How accessible it is, I don't know. And it could be similar to what you're saying in terms of the people in the UK, in Scotland, they have to come all the way to the UK, London, to register their vote. And that's not easy. You can't, if you live in Scotland, you can't just get up and, do you know what I mean? If I want to vote in the UK, I walk 2 minutes around the corner to my polling station.
And sometimes I'm debating with myself, should I make this journey or not?
Exactly. And it's true. Exactly. And it's only 5 minutes. So let alone a journey that's going to be 5 hours, you know? So accessibility is an issue. But I've, like you said, I think that's a global issue in terms of like, because normally what you find with diplomatic missions is that they're based in capital cities and cities of influence. But of course, your diaspora is spread everywhere.
Yeah.
So accessibility is always going to be an issue. But this is where you have consulates and other smaller diplomatic missions, which should be able to facilitate that. So I know that there's consulates in, I think there's one in Glasgow and Edinburgh, Ghana consulate.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that facilitates voting. It should do. But I'm not entirely sure. So accessibility is definitely, and I think that's a big thing, because I think anytime you're engaging the diaspora in general and you're telling them to engage with Ghana, contribute to Ghana, invest in Ghana, you have to make that accessible. You can't just say it without it being accessible. It doesn't make any sense.
It's got to be accessible.
Yeah.
But the publicizing it and talking about it must make Ghanaians feel, even though you are in diaspora, you are meant to feel like Ghanaian, wherever you are.
Indeed.
And that is kind of a challenge, because a lot of politicians, and it's very sad to say, look at Ghana, your president, all educated in the West, practices a lawyer in the West. But when he goes back home, I don't know what happens to politicians. They begin to localize their thinking. Because these people, and it's not one in Ghana, you know, there are very many. Way back, I mean, I did my own research, and I promise you, I was shocked, like in Kenya, talking about governors in different counties. And I was shocked in one time. There was about three governors, formerly graduates of Harvard University in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They're like, where do things go wrong with all this knowledge, exposure? You've traveled, you've studied abroad, you're exposed. What happens to you when you go down, back to the roots?
Yeah,
there's something that doesn't really add up. But what I'm saying is, like, in the same case, when you come to Ghana, I know they are very senior politicians, very senior public servants, who are also, if we were to call them alumni of diaspora, right? We could, because they are.
They studied
abroad,
Oxford,
they worked
Cambridge,
abroad,
yeah.
And now they are on the ground, but they are looking at the youths in diaspora, and they're not doing anything. There's no... Let me not assume there's no mentorship of some sort to like, if I'm a politician on the ground in Ghana, I'll say, oh, guys, yeah, our government is encouraging you guys to come back home. I know what you are going through. I went through this same stuff in the UK or in the US because I was there. You know, when you come back, we can mentor you to politics, into professions. Is that happening or... Am I raising my expectation in unrealistic manner?
I mean, I hope it's happening. I hope it's happening. It should be happening. Mm. I mean, I couldn't answer that in total confidence.
Yeah.
But what I would say to your point is that, you know, when you spoke about being localized, sometimes what I think it is that, like, it's what we said, what I said before in terms of, like, people saying, well, you know, that's just the way Ghana is, unless acclimatized to Ghana. I think sometimes people can get swallowed up by the system. And I think, you know, in Ghana and Africa, the position that we're in, we really need radical leaders, radical thinkers and ethical thinkers as well. People that are going to do the right thing, but also be radical with it. Because, like, you know, if you just allow the system to swallow you up, then you'll be repeating the same things that we've been doing for years, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of it comes into play. It's power, it's different types of things. But we need, you know, I don't want to get too political because we're non-partisan and we don't really, as an organization, we don't side with any political party or anything like that. We just hope that the government of the day does right by the Ghanaian people, and that's what we hope. But what I would say to whoever the next incoming president is really to prioritize the youth and be radical in your thinking about changing Ghana. I think let's not accept things just because that's just the way they've been, you know. And at some point, I think we need to sacrifice in terms of, like, you know, I know we get a lot of aid and we get a lot of stuff from the West, but we need to, if we're ever going to be sustainable, at some point we need to sacrifice. At some point. And it's going to take a hit on the people. And I get it. I think no leader wants to be the leader to be the one that's going to sacrifice. But for the ultimate betterment of the country, it needs to be done. Because the borrowing of loans and being indebted to the IMF, that doesn't make you sustainable as a country. So yeah, but I'll let the politicians do what they need to do. They're more qualified than I am. So.
Yeah. Even though, let me tell you something that of course, you're dealing with youths, and this is very important, even for the youths. The thing is that, let me tell you something. Before Ghanaian independence, before any other African country's independence, it took the youths to see the impact of colonization upon their lives.
Yeah.
And it took the youths of the time to rise up and do something about it. I mean, the likes of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the likes of Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, the likes of Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya, all these leaders, right? And not just them, there are others who are youthful in their prime. Mm-hmm. And their circumstances, right, were harder, Why do I say so? They were fighting colonialists. Yeah. Colonialists with guns, with all the power, with all the prejudice, and prejudice to human life, especially if you yeah. are from those countries. But they rose and they fought.
Yeah,
indeed. And the rest is history.
Yes.
African countries got their independence. They so did. What message are we sending to youths today? The things that they see,
yeah.
that should not be happening.
Indeed. I mean, I think the first thing we need to be is ethical and honest. I think that's the message that you have to give to the young people. Because I think, don't get me wrong, like it was never going to be easy for Ghana or any other African countries, you know, post-independence. Because yes, you're free and you're free to run your own affairs, but you haven't been doing so for so long. And also, let's not forget, you know, that colonialism did take from Africa a lot. You know, so you're almost working at a deficit. But that's even more reason for you to be honest about the situation and really work for the people. Unfortunately, what happens normally in these situations is not just in Ghana, is that there's a power grab. You know, there's a shuffle and a shuffle for power. And sometimes that overrides really what is the best for the country. And that's the position where, you know, a lot of Africa is in. Personally as well, you know, you spoke about Kwame Nkrumah and his vision of Pan-Africanism. I think he'd be quite saddened about how things have turned out, because even as Africa, I don't think as countries we work together enough. And when I say that, obviously there's trade embargo, there's trade agreements between countries, you know, there's ECOWAS, there's all these different groups, you know, the African Union and stuff like that. But I mean, in terms of actually in solidarity, you know, maybe to put up a front against some of the other powers, I don't think that's done enough. Like, our interests are not, you know, fought for enough. And I think, you know, regardless of what's happened to Africa, it's a valuable continent. You know, anybody would ask China how valuable Ghana is.
Africa
is in general.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about coltan in the Congo, the gold, all the resources.
Everything
comes from Africa. So yeah. we're vital to the effective running of the world, really. And I think we need to use that power more effectively, you know, so.
This is Colorful Radio.
Colorful Radio.
Yeah, when you look into the youths again in Africa, as in Ghana, many countries in Africa,
yeah.
very important point I wanted to say. You have governments in power that they invest, some of them invest in the learning situation. Of course, they give them some student loans or whatever. They participate in the educating youths. But these youths who wanted to become medical doctors, these youths who wanted to become engineers, they are churned out of so many universities in any particular country in Africa in a year's time. But they are churned out into nothing. Because there's this culture in many countries in Africa. They broker deals, they are given loans by foreign countries like China, like UK, like USA, like even Russia, or whichever other country that gives loans, and they give them contracts to build infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
When this is happening, some of the agreements are, we're going to bring our own engineers. And the ones that are being churned out locally from universities, they graduate into nothing.
Yeah.
There's no jobs for them because all our infrastructure is being done by countries that have been given the contract, but they bring their own people to work on these places.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at it from the point of youth, I meet with youths and I feel bad about it when they say, university degree doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
I graduated, I have a master's. And others, let me surprise you. You see someone with master's putting a small banner on his, holding it by his chest.
Yeah.
Get me a job. I'm a graduate in this.
Yeah.
These are youths. Youths experience on the ground in Africa.
Yeah.
How can we overcome that? I mean, what are your thoughts when you see situations like this?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think, going back to what you said, I think you know, when I spoke about bargaining power, I think this is where it needs to come to the fore, because when you speak about, you know, these contracts, like, at the end of the day, you know, foreign countries or foreign investment, they're coming into your country because they see value. That's why they want to invest. Otherwise, they wouldn't come. So you need to use that as a bargaining tool. So the whole thing that you spoke about, okay, well, then they bring their own people. We need to broker better agreements where to say, well, no, actually, you know, 40% of your workplace has to, workforce has to be local.
Local, yeah.
And they need to have guaranteed jobs at the end of it. We need to be better in that negotiation because they're clearly coming, you know, to invest in the country because they see its worth. So we need to understand the worth. But unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. You know, and it's sad because, like we said, the young people, you know, who can't get jobs will just be disillusioned. They'll be disenfranchised and they will look elsewhere, you know, and that's something we can't really afford to do. So, you know, we really need to look at really putting ourselves first and really understanding the value that we bring. I think we understand it, but I think when it comes to the bargaining, I just don't think we seem not to have the leverage. And it's, you know, it's even similar in the Caribbean, you know, when, you know, with the foreign powers that come there to build hotels, you know, the land that they're given. I was in Jamaica recently in November and I spoke to locals, and some of the locals born bred there, they can't even access their local beach because it's been shut off by, you know, it's been bought by hotels and they're not allowed on there, you know. So it's all these type of things. And I feel like, in a way, if we're not careful, you know, I don't want to be radical, but it could be like a small form of colonialism all over again, you know. So we really need to look at that and really understand that, you know, the youth really are the future, and we need to set up for them.
When you look globally, a very controversial question, mm-hmm. when you look at the global world, immediately, of course, this is important because I just came at the back of African Leadership Week.
Yeah.
And when you look into the global setup, immediately, United Nations Security Council, 5 countries with veto power. Mm-hmm. We have seen very good illustration with Russia joining forces with another group of countries. They call them BRICS. Mm-hmm. BRICS countries, mm-hmm. and their agenda, those group of countries, is to fight the setup that has always been there, Western-fronted, NATO-fronted, all this kind of situation, whereby mm-hmm. Immediately you have the United Nations, you have the 5 members with the veto power, and then immediately you have financial institutions like the Bretton Woods institution, you have IMF, your World Bank, running the agenda, mm-hmm. dictating to the economies of other countries how they should be run. And then when you see the experience of Gaza, war in Gaza, Israel being supported by the US, US all the time giving, supplying weapons to Israel. But in a minute, when the rest of the world has fought it to allow end and ceasefire, yeah, America vetoes, uses their veto power to let the war carry on. Mm-hmm. When you look into all this setup, if you're a young person in Africa, and you look at, where's Africa in all this? You see, Africa right now, Russia is pushing their agenda. China, on the same side, they are pushing their strength in Africa. The same thing is the Western Hemisphere countries like UK, US. And Africa is just there, torn between all these countries. But each country from the West, mm-hmm. they have an interest in Africa.
Of course.
They're looking at the minerals. They're looking at the resources.
Yeah.
And they're building their military bases in different countries, in those countries and in Africa, to further their agenda, serve interest, protect their interest, economic interest, and all that. So if you are a youth, just seeing all this happening around us, what should be our thought? What should be our thinking? Where do we go with this? Because, yeah, you can be radical in a country like Kenya, Ghana, or Tanzania, wherever. But at the end of it, you're like, how far can I take this? My president, maybe, could be, depending on which country, a youth may say my president is a puppet of the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a difficult position, you know, 100%. And you know, for young people, often when they look, I mean, you look at, you know, a lot of the protests around, you mentioned Gaza and Israel. The majority of the protests are from young people. You know, they're seeing the injustices and stuff like that, and it can be a difficult thing to watch and see unfold. You know, because in a sense that you want to be hopeful for the future, and there is so much to be hopeful for in terms of the talent and the natural resources in Africa. But like you say, when you look at the political makeup, you think, can this actually be realized because of all these constraints? And I think. You know, they say charity starts at home. I think it starts with us. You know, we have to be ethical. We have to do the right thing. And we have to come together. You know, it's not one country. Africa has to come together. And once we're on that page, then I think you can see things will shift. Because automatically, the international community will have to give some kudos or some element of respect. But I think the way Africa is shaped up at the moment is very individualistic, and it's very much kind of, you know, their fate is in the hands of, you know, the powers that be. Whereas if we come together, we do the right thing in our countries first, you know, and then we come together, I think that can be the start of where we see, you know, the fruit begin to, you know, things come to fruition. But until then, you know, I feel like we're forever going to be, you know, indebted. And this is why I said, you know, at some point, there has to be sacrifice. You know, how many loans are you going to take from World Bank? How many loans are you going to take from the IMF? Like, at what point are we going to be sustainable? So we need to, you know, we need to really sacrifice. And like I said, you know, I think there'll be many, as you said, there'll be many a youth around Africa who potentially thinks that their leaders are puppets of the West. But it's like, what can they do? I think as well, you know, we spoke about democracy, and whilst Ghana, you know, to be honest, has a good proud record of democracy, you know, particularly in terms of elections, you see that our elections tend to go without incident. The changeover of power is relatively smooth compared to other African countries. I think that's where other African countries need to improve, because I think, you know, the way other, you know, leaders or countries hold on to power is just not a good example for the youth. But also it also keeps power secluded. Whereas, you know, we spoke about radical thought, you know, that radical thought won't be able to come to the forefront because it's the same. Because even when you look at some countries in Africa, it's like it's the same fraternity running the country. You know, even if the president's another party has come in power or whatever, you know, they're all linked some way.
They're all the same.
They're all linked. And sometimes even it's hierarchical. You see that the president's son becomes next. And so where is the change of thinking if only one section of society is being allowed to lead the country?
That's true.
And that's where the democracy needs to come, where it needs to be spread far and wide. Like, you know, somebody who was selling plantain at the roadside should be able, if they've got the skills, to one day go and lead the country. But, you know, sometimes one of the things that we need to admit, you know, as Africans, and sometimes we, you know, we say it in countries like the UK, but Africa is elitist. The same way that we have hierarchy, we have in Africa,
yeah,
as
we
well.
Do.
You know, if we're honest about it, and we have to be honest to say we need to break that. If we want to see, you know, have a fair representation across the board.
Yeah.
You know, because power is often secluded, you know, amongst families or tribes or whatever. And that shouldn't be. It should be that everyone should have access to it. So this is why I say charity starts at home.
Sure.
If we're not even doing right by ourselves, how can we then compete on the international stage?
It's not going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to happen. You know, you reminded me of a great soldier, and this soldier, yeah, he used to every morning remind his own son to make his own bed, until every time the son makes his bed, you make a big fuss about it. And in the end, he said to him, right, making your bed is symbolism of the rest of your life. Because this bed gave you comfort while you were sleeping.
Yeah.
When you wake up, don't forget that. So every time he makes the bed, each morning, he had to remember that the bed gave him comfort entire night.
Yeah.
And he said to him, this is the beginning of you becoming someone with integrity. Yeah. Someone who is appreciative, you know, for many aspects of your life. A simple procedure like that. So I think we, in Africa, we need to make our bed.
No,
we need to learn how to make our bed.
That's a good
regularly.
That's a good analogy. That's definitely good. And that you mentioned the word integrity. Yeah. Integrity in leadership is so crucial.
It's crucial. So we need to make that bed. You know, our countries in Africa. Let's make our bed.
Yeah, let's do
that. And let's learn from it.
Yeah,
and get on from there. So, to our listeners, thanks for being with us, and of course, this is all we have for today. Very. Great thanks to you being with us.
Yes.
And of course, it's the beginning of many.
Indeed. Can I just say, on a positive, the future of Ghana is bright. It's 100% bright if we're able to tap into the resources and the potential that we have, particularly amongst young people.
Yeah.
Feel free to follow Future of Ghana on our socials at Future of GH or at Future of Ghana, depending on what social it is, and you'll see the amazing talent that we're engaging. So let's stay hopeful. We've got many challenges, but let's stay hopeful that the next 67 Party people!
This is Colourful Radio.
Hell yeah.
Should I repeat that? Yeah, man, I wanna be.